Well, good day, everybody, and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody here with us today. We've got a great show for you tonight. We're actually recording in an off night because we wanted to make sure we caught up with our guest this evening, and we'll have more about him in just a few minutes. But of course, it wouldn't be a Disaster Podcast episode if we didn't have our good friend and co-host on, Sam Bradley.
Hello, Jamie. Yeah, it's kind of fun this close together. And it seems as though this is Disaster Author Week, and it's been amazing. These are people who've not only had some amazing experiences, but they had the ability to document them for other people. So I'm really excited about this one, like the last one we did, because Renee has, oh my God, it would take us an hour just to go through his resume. But I'm sure he'll have a lot to share with us. So, Renee Steinhauer, we'll talk about your book in a bit, but tell us a little bit about yourself and some of the million things you've done in terms of disaster.
Well, hello, hey, and thank you so much for inviting me to be on the show with you guys. Wonderful work that you're doing, spreading the word about disaster, CISM, and of course the training and such. Real excited to be with you guys. I've been a disaster guy for many years. First disaster was 1986 with the California floods of Northern California, and been continuing since then. Over the years, I've kind of become a disaster expert because I've been to the vast majority of the disasters now.
I think I call it disaster junkie, but that's just me.
Disaster junkie is probably a more appropriate title.
Well, here's a question I'll throw out, and I want to hear more about you, Renee, and some of the things you've done. But what is it? This is a good question for you. What is it that makes us keep wanting to go back to some of the worst places in some of the worst environments ever?
It's a hard question to answer. I think one of the things that there are two reasons, really. One is I like to make organization out of chaos, and a disaster is if it's any sort of disaster, it's crazy, absolute crazy. And to be able to take that craziness and create a team, to create a system that looks like the incident command system, and be able to start mobilizing patients, personnel, and supplies to get people's lives saved. That's really what we like to do. And the other thing is, I do it well, and I like doing things that I do well. So it keeps me coming back. But it's an important job, and I love being part of disasters.
So what do you bring home with you? We all bring a piece of it home with you. We leave a piece of us wherever we were. And there's good parts and there's bad parts. What are some of the key things that you always bring home?
Well, I got to say, there's a lot of times I bring home some of the bad parts. I can't deny having a fair share of nightmares and such with the hard critical decisions we make on triage and such. But there are other times where we get to bring home, you know, those moments where you've been able to share with an individual, and it's usually one individual, something that you get to make a difference in an individual's life. In Haiti, I was able to work to get a gentleman rescued who, by all rights, would have normally died with 40% burns to his body, mostly through his face and chest. You just wouldn't have expected him to live, but we actually not only rescued him out of the disaster zone, got him treatment in the United States for the burns, and he lived through the event.
And we do want to hear about that. Is part of what I read, and I definitely want to hear that story in a little more detail. So you are a medic and a nurse?
That's correct.
Okay, just like Jamie. Yeah.
Yep. Yeah. So paramedic since 1992 and a nurse since 1999.
So would it be safe to say this has made you much better at both of those roles, just the experiences that you've tossed yourself into and just the function of, you know, working on your feet and having to make spur-of-the-moment decisions on things?
Most certainly. You know, with medics, medics tend to be natural born leaders, so they really do well in the disaster environment. And nurses who take on a greater leadership role also tend to do well in the disaster environment. And there are certain skills that are emphasized in each of those career fields, and being able to take those skills and being able to bring them out to the field in a unique and different way is one of the enjoyable aspects of having both certifications.
And one thing I found with our DMAT is, you know, medics are used to a chaotic environment. They work in the field. They never know what the next call is going to be, or, you know, what kind of chaos is going to reign. Where, you know, most nurses that work in hospitals have a lot more controlled environment. So I think it's a harder transition for some of those nurses. But boy, when they get out there, you can't get them to they don't want to go back in the hospital. They want to stay out in that environment. And I think it really adds a lot to their skill set.
I would have to agree. I have worked in a number of places where we've taken nurses and brought them into the disaster world. We did that in Haiti, in Liberia during the Ebola response. We had a number of nurses who actually weren't able to make the transition from hospital organized and everything working in a particular way to disaster environment where there are many unknowns. And some of them actually had to go home. They weren't actually able to get into the middle of the disaster out there. And we saw that in Haiti with a few doctors working in the OR that, you know, that OR is normally a very, you know, organized, structured, non-chaotic place. But when you're running three or four surgeries simultaneously and patients are dying left and right, we had surgeons that weren't able to manage that. But the ones who don't want to go back to the hospital because there is a greater challenge and there is a greater reward.
Yes.
Daniel Swanson, who had worked as the nurse in Haiti and ended up working as incident commander, having no disaster experience but was trained in the field, she described it as one of the most, I believe she said it was like one of her worst experiences and one of her best experiences simultaneously, because the challenges were amazing, the heartbreak was amazing, but she never felt that she had done anything or will do anything as important or challenging as she did out there.
So, Renee, before we dig into Haiti, which we certainly want to do, I know you've had a lot of experience with different countries, with different people. People may not know the difference between like an NGO and a formalized team, and you've kind of had a mix of all of those things. Tell us a little bit about some of those other experiences.
Well, thank you very much. Yeah, I've started off working with the American Red Cross back in 1986. I was part of their volunteer organization, as well as a photographer. Eventually, I became a paramedic and a nurse and started working on more of the international projects. With some of the NGOs, I worked with the American Refugee Committee out in Rwanda, working with refugees out there. I was with the Global Medic out of Canada, where we worked the Asian Tsunami, another NGO. The NGO that I work most frequently with is Remote Area Medical out of Knoxville, Tennessee. And with them, I usually manage a lot of their international disaster responses, as well as lead some of their teams on the international primary health care missions in Guyana, Honduras, and wherever is needed. So I kind of have a broad variety, but then on the there are other options in some of these responses, such as Liberia, where, well, I was working, but I wasn't a volunteer. I was with another NGO called AmeriCares, who was paying nurses to come out to the to work with Ebola, and there's even possible I was working with the United Nations, but as a subcontractor to another organization who had a contract with the UN to fly medevac for combat casualties within Mali. So there's a lot of different ways to be involved, and I've generally managed to find just about all of them.
Well, and usually we talk about this at the end of the show, but I'll throw it out now. We love to have our audience come up on the website and ask questions of guests. And I think that anybody that might be interested in finding an NGO or a service to work with may come up with some questions for you if you're willing to answer them.
Well, I'm certainly willing to answer any questions. If I'm not around, you can always email me. That's I'm easy to be found. But there are thousands of NGOs, and it's just a matter of kind of finding where you fit in best. Many of the religious-based NGOs tend to have better funding, so you'll find that they will pay for your transportation and costs and such to go to a disaster. An organization like Remote Area Medical is non-religious, non-political. We all pay all of our own expenses, but on the flip side is we tend to find people who are really highly motivated. This is where we spend our vacation money and our vacation time, and we'll end up working wherever we need to be. So there's just a wide variety of options for people who want to get involved.
Maybe I should have asked you where you haven't gone. That would have been a shorter conversation. But let's talk about Haiti. And, of course, my DMAT went there. I was not a part of that deployment, so I certainly have heard their experiences. But Saving Jimani is a book you wrote about that particular experience when you went to Haiti. And tell us a little more in depth about that, and especially about that patient you referred to with the burn injury. That I haven't gotten too far into it, but I've been totally fascinated by what I've read. And I did get that far. So tell us about that experience.
Well, Haiti has to be the most difficult assignment of my life. Now, I'm also a combat medic who's done multiple tours within Iraq. I've been in Afghanistan and some of the worst places on the planet, but nothing has been as challenging as Haiti. With Haiti, we were with a very small team from Remote Area Medical that was requested to go to a town on the border of the Dominican Republic. So we weren't in the center of Port-au-Prince. We arrived and we found that the town had been overwhelmed. The Dominican government had actually opened their borders to allow the Haitians to cross the border, but then they closed the roads just past the town. So this way they could claim that the borders were open, but they didn't want the rest of the Haitians moving into the center of their country. Their country had already been overwhelmed by a number of the Haitians who had managed to get in. So we had thousands of critically injured Haitians who now were far away from Port-au-Prince. Nobody knew where they were, and they ended up collecting at a place called Good Samaritan Hospital, which really was just a medical clinic that was built for traveling medical teams. And then there was an orphanage next to it. So we converted the orphanage into a hospital, and we started doing surgical operations, removing that. We had to do a lot of amputations of arms and legs, about 250 amputations a day for the first few days, and then the orphanage became a post-surgical hospital over the course of the time. The challenges were amazing. When we think about incident command system, when we think about the kind of start triage, all that went out the door. Incident command systems made to move people to a definitive care facility. We didn't have definitive care facility. We were planning to send people to a definitive care facility once it all kind of started, and eventually I realized we're it. We have to build our hospital. And that's what we eventually did, was build a hospital. And in the midst of this, the one gentleman, Mr. Eric Louis, who had suffered terrible burns, we originally thought we can take care of him because we had some resources that had joined forces with us. By the time we had found him in Port-au-Prince and brought him into Jimani, these doctors that had joined forces with us actually got kicked out of the country. And so now we didn't have these resources, and we realized we also had even more casualties arrive. So he went from being someone who I thought we can take care of, and he's now an immediate patient, to he went to becoming a non-salvageable patient because we had no resources. The amount of fluids that we would spend on him, the amount of resources we would use on him would have meant that other people would have died who were more likely to live. Eventually, as we got more resources and such, we were actually able to take him out of the expectant category and put him back into an immediate category, where he was eventually flown out and received the life-saving care that he needed. But it was challenging every single day. And every day was a new challenge. Literally, we were making life and death decisions all day long for days at a time.
And I have to tell you, Jamie, I don't know if you've had a chance to read this yet, but he writes from his gut. He really does. And much like the other author we talked about. And you sense that. And the way he describes meeting them for the first time and this man's wife attending him and being with him like every step of the way. And even though she in her own mind isn't sure he's going to survive, those are some things. You know, we're trying to telling the bones of the story, but you really have to read the book to get the sentiment and how you felt about these things and your own emotions as they went from one thing to another as this whole story unfolds. And I just had to throw that out there because that's not something that we can communicate as well, you know, talking about it the way we are now.
No, and we need to make sure that we, you know, folks, as always, when we interview an author like this, we will make sure there are links to the book so that you can get it for yourself and get the full picture. And we understand, you know, Renee, that we can't, you know, we're just scratching the surface here, but, you know, your book's going to go a whole lot more in depth on these things.
Thank you. Thank you so much. You know, I've actually gotten a lot of interesting comments on Amazon and via personal mail from a wide variety. People who read it, who are in emergency management and disaster managers, read it and see a completely different view than someone who's never been in a disaster before, maybe a nurse or paramedic who is just wanting to read about what it's like. And each one of them takes away a different lesson, which is part of what I've wanted to do. I've wanted to tell a story. I've wanted people to understand what it is to be in a disaster, which is hard. You can't just read about a text and understand incident command and say, yes, I know what it is to be in a disaster. I've wanted people to feel what it is to make these decisions. Logic is irrelevant. It has to be followed, but it becomes irrelevant at a point, and you have to feel the visceral instincts that are within you and sometimes fight those instincts to do the right thing. And so these people who read it, those, like I said, the people who've got no medical experience, they go, holy smoke, this is amazing, this is strange, this is bizarre. And those who are reading it are like, wow, I never considered that this is what it would actually be like to have to do this. Because most of us, if we stay in the career for 20 years, if you're a medic, if you're an emergency nurse, you're a doc, you are likely to experience this maybe one time in your career. Mm-hmm. Those of us who do this more frequently, who volunteer, we tend to do it a little bit more. Paramedics maybe get something like this once or twice in a year, but it's once or twice in a career, but it's not something that that anybody gets a whole lot of experience with unless you're constantly trying to. So it's an important work for people who want to understand what's happening and how to do their best in such an environment.
And something I hadn't thought about was something you alluded to earlier, that where you get the wrong people out there, the people that think they want to do this, because everybody wants to be out there when there's the big one. And then they get out there and realize they're way over their head. So reading this book from the perspective at which you wrote it is like, whoa, maybe not. Maybe this is not something I want to be involved in. Or for those that really would be good at it, they're going to really get inspired about, you know what, I'm going to go sign up for an NGO. I'm going out on the next one.
Most certainly. And there are a few people that I would say are the wrong person for this. There are people in this environment, any one of us could have been overcome. And if you read the book, you'll see I was broken. There was a point where I was just devastated by what happened. I was lucky to recover. People go and they do their best. We need people to put it out on the line, to take a risk, to take a shot to help others. Because in the catastrophic disaster, we need as many boots on the ground as we can get. And yes, some people will fail. Some people will come, they will look, they will turn around and go home. And that happened. A lot of people will stay and work even beyond their limitations and go home devastated by what they've seen. And that's hard because we didn't have the kind of opportunities to really kind of help those in those first few days who were really devastated. But it is a sacrifice that each of these volunteers makes.
Well, and let's pause on that point for a minute, because we've talked about that a lot. You're never going to walk away from a situation like that, even if you did your best and you know you did your best and you went out of your way and you did some great things. There's always a piece of you that's going to be left behind, like I said. And also, you're going to be broken a little bit. I mean, I worked ground zero. Nobody that did walked away whole. But the whole key to that is getting the right kind of help, getting the right kind of support when you come back, and not just stuffing it in your chest and saying, ah, I'm good, I'm going to move on to the next one. It's so critically important if you want to continue to go out there and do that work. You got to clean it up from the last one so you can go out there and function on the next one. Would you agree with that?
I wholeheartedly agree with that, and thank you for your time with working at Ground Zero. Yes, anybody who's been there understands that you don't walk away from this without leaving a part of your heart. That's why we go there. We go there to give part of our heart, but we hope it grows back. When I came back from Haiti, within 24 hours of being on the ground, I was in critical incident stress debriefing that was made available to me by my ambulance employer, Bayshore Ambulance. And just recently, I've returned from Liberia after having a fairly traumatic deployment out there. And again, I've gone back and made sure I got some counseling, because I may be really good at disaster, but there are some areas of trying to fix myself that I'm not as good at. And people need to have that professional help, get tuned back up so that you can be ready for the next one to take care of people who need it.
And I think that's a really critically important point, no matter how good you are, and you're damn good at this. You've done it many times at many different levels. You still need some interaction. You still need some diffusing and debriefing, and you just gotta do that. Nobody is going to be exempt from that.
Most certainly.
Yeah, and I think that it's important. You know, Joe talks about this. I wish he was here on the call, because, you know, he talks about taking his USAR team out, and, you know, how you need to, he has a whole strategy for how he identifies the team members that need a day off the line, in the midst of a disaster that they've been going full tilt, full strong too long, and they need to come off the line for a day or two to get themselves back on track. And he notices different things about it. He's mentioned this in the past. You know, people start having little nagging complaints, and they become more serious because they're not taking care of themselves the way they should. And so that's his signal sometimes to say this person needs a break. Do you see that kind of thing? Is it something that now that you've done this more times, you're more likely to recognize that in yourself, or do you still have some of those blind spots?
I would have to acknowledge that I believe I have a certain amount of blind spots. And part of that happens when I'm just so overwhelmed by what I'm doing myself. In these first few days of disaster management, when I work these operations, I specialize in going into places where there is no other resource happening. So it's very difficult to be able to do much more than just get people going, get them fed if I can, and occasionally get some sleep. So I have to say I'm not the best at that. But I have seen it, especially on some of the smaller disasters. I was out in the Philippines with after the typhoon hit 2013 with Ram, and yeah, we see some volunteers who are obviously having some issues, and you sit them down in the evening, we sit down, we chit chat, we get some things going, get them talking, and generally it's a informal debriefing, but it's an opportunity to get people talking, because there were certain things. People worried about the risks of rebel forces that we were encountering and all sorts of stuff, and they need to be able to express that fear, and they need to know that it's normal. And from the people like myself who've been around for a while, they need to know that I think, yes, that's dangerous, and maybe perhaps we shouldn't have been where there were rebel forces. Let's not do that tomorrow. Things like that. They need to know that, because without expressing that fear, then it just builds up within them. And so I do occasionally see it, but I certainly think I have missed it many times.
Well, that kind of brings up an interesting perspective, because I'm used to working in a very well-organized team. That's we've created the team in 1997, and most of those members, we've known each other for that long. We deployed together before, but, you know, because the key to this is looking out for each other, like Jamie was saying, something you may not recognize in yourself, but you may recognize something in someone else, and you have the ability to let them know that and to help them act on it. But when you're going into, you're picking the environments where there are no resources, you're walking into a situation where you have to create a team, and then get to the point where there's enough trust and enough, you know, I'm not exactly friendship, but at least a relationship between people where they're going to be feeling free to talk to each other. How does that work?
It's challenging, but I find that when the stresses are greater, there is less ego and there is more bonding. And it's true. Ram, while frequently go in with a relatively small team, we will back that up with another 10 or 15 people that show up to work with us. But we consistently interact with other teams. We will join forces. Many times our teams will end up utilizing the same living quarters. We'll mobilize together. As we start finding teams that need more, say, leadership, that they want to go someplace, but they don't know what to do, they'll just join us, and we will just start bringing them in. We've got no problem partnering with people. In Haiti, by the time I left, we had more than 400 volunteers, but we started with a 12-man team. And
wow.
I don't know how many organizations were combined with us. And it's just the way it is. We don't have some system that says, oh, well, we're the top dog and everyone bows to us. That's just not who we are. We're used to going into where there is nothing, and let's collaborate. Let's do what needs to be done. And I truly find that very quickly that the friendships are made between different organizations. You make strong bonds with people that you just met within a few days, and those who continue to come back, and there's a core group of us that do that. We tend to see each other on all the big disasters, and we're like, yeah, all right, how you going? I haven't seen you since, you know, Haiti. I haven't seen you since the Philippines, whatever it is. And that's just how it works.
Well, you know, and we could keep talking all night about this, I'm sure, but you know, it's something that we really, I think, need to just direct people to the book. So tell us the title of the book again, where they can find it, and how they can get more information.
The book is Save Ijumani, Life and Death in the Haiti Earthquake, and you can find it on Amazon.com. You can also go to my webpage at www.ReneeSteinhauer.com and learn a little bit more about the book, see some photos, videos, and such. And that's pretty much it. It's I think it's a good book, and it's an important book to describe what really happened out there.
Well, I have another question for you, too, on that note, because I'm looking at this disparate team that you're creating out there. Is there any opportunity to do training? I mean, you're all coming from different backgrounds with different experiences, and somehow you have to find a common bond and a common way of functioning. Is that something you're able to do?
Yes and no. In Haiti, it was very unusual because the vast majority of the people we had coming in had zero disaster training. So something such as START triage, impossible to do. I'm trying to talk to people about immediate patients, and they don't know what an immediate patient is, nor do they know how to triage an immediate patient. That makes it a little bit more difficult. For us, we had to kind of adjust our triage and let everyone know how it was going to happen. So that first day, just before sundown, I said, hey, listen, anybody you think will die before sundown, put them in this one area. That's an immediate patient. After sunset, we had to re-triage all these patients again and say, all right, anybody who you think will die before sunrise, now that's an immediate patient. And that's some really basic training that we did with Daniel Swanson, who ended up being an incident commander. I needed to work on trying to come up with a way to get our most criticals out. And she was trained in the incident command system with very basic training, and then put into the leadership role, where she did an outstanding job. And I, you know, backed her up when she needed, but then I continued on taking care of some special issues that needed to be resolved. In the Philippines, we weren't in such a critical situation after the first couple of days, and there was an opportunity for us to do a much greater deal of training. We had a team leader who needed – she was a doc who had never been a team leader, so I assigned her as a team leader and started helping her work with some of the interpersonal issues of the team and such. We had another doctor that was working with a Harvard program on – I don't know what his program was, but he needed to be doing some very specialized skills that were available with the United Nations and a military unit that was going out. As things slowed down, I was able to actually connect him with the military, put him on a helicopter, and send him out to go do some of these things that he was training on anyways and that the UN needed completed. So there are times to train, and then there are times to just go forward. And with the lack of training, you just give – very basic instructions. Everyone gets one task. You complete the task, you come back, and I give you another one.
So you could almost say the lack of training opportunity requires just really good leadership and kind of go with the flow as you go and instruct as you go.
I would totally agree with that. Yeah, if you don't have a bunch of people who really know what they're doing, you've got to have leadership that can get people doing stuff. An example, again, that happened in Haiti. We had a gal, excellent gal. I worked with her many times, but I needed her to man a manpower pool. And I got to tell you, I think a manpower pool is one of the most important aspects in disaster, and nobody talks about it. But you've got to have people that do a task that doesn't take a special skill and then come back and are utilized again. Getting her to manage that team and being able to get people that are collected and go and do what needs to be done, she couldn't do it because she didn't have the leadership ability. When I decided that she wasn't going to be able to do it, I brought in another guy who was an ex-Special Forces colonel who absolutely had the leadership. And if I needed two people, I put two fingers in the air. Two people were walking towards me in a matter of seconds. And so we had litter bearers. We had runners to transmit information. We had whatever we needed within seconds. And that is a critical component for an operation like that, where the resources are minimal, communications are busted. You need litter bearers. You need non-technical people. You got to have a manpower pool.
Well, then, as we say in DMAT, everybody belongs to logistics, no matter what level you are, whether you're an EMT or a physician or whatever else. But say one of our listeners gets really inspired by this. What advice would you give them if they have an interest in doing disaster medicine? And what kind of training would you recommend? Because that's a question we get quite often.
Oh, well, there's a lot of training. Medically, I'd highly recommend anybody, regardless of whether you're a nurse, you're a doctor, you should go through the basic EMT training to understand some of the more emergent types of things. However, the reality in these large catastrophic disasters, the vast majority of them are not bandaging and doing splints and such. The vast majority of them are really public health issues. You're doing primary health care. So you should know some emergency stuff. You should know some primary health care stuff and some public health stuff. In addition to that, you definitely need to have a good understanding of the incident command system so that you follow it or you implement it if nobody else is. The incident command education is free, and it's offered with FEMA online as well as part of most EMT basic courses and paramedic training. Not as frequent with doctors and nurses who are training, and I'd love to see that change. But incident command, some basic emergency information, and then just get out there and go do it. I've been on many, many large-scale disasters where people have zero experience doing this, zero training doing this, but they've got heart, they've got willingness, and some basic medical knowledge. And as long as they're willing to take orders, they end up doing amazing things.
And you're right, and I agree. I think ICS is that common understanding of ICS can really create some order out of that chaos.
Most certainly.
So, Jamie, you got any questions? You've been patiently listening.
No. And I'm just, you know, we're at the end of our time frame, unfortunately. But, you know, I I think we could probably talk to Renee on all evening.
Well, we may have to do it again.
We may have to have
you
back.
I'm sure he'll be out there having more experiences.
Definitely.
I would love to chat with you guys. It's a shame we haven't even had a chance to talk a little bit about Vanuatu. You know, a hurricane just hit there.
Yes.
Big need. Volunteers are needed out there. People should really think about that. Not the kind of dramatic stuff that you saw in the Philippines or in Haiti, but the vast majority of disaster is not sexy stuff. It's people in need, and there's a place where people are in need, where people can volunteer. What an excellent place to start.
Absolutely, absolutely, and I completely agree. And like you said earlier, this is something you've been to many, many times. But for some responders out there, this is a once in a career situation that they may run into. If that's something you want to be prepared for in your own area, sometimes being a volunteer on someone else's disaster situation can help prepare you for that once in a career incident when it does happen in your community. So this is a great opportunity for some people to get a handle on what they might expect if something like a devastating earthquake or a tornado or something were to strike here in the U.S. Would you agree with that, Renee?
Oh, Jamie, you took the words out of my mouth. I totally agree with that. And I've been pushing for cities to start sending their paramedics, their nurses on such assignments. Certainly it's goodwill, but more importantly, when their city has a disaster, you'll have people with a mindset that understand disaster in a level that nobody else does.
Jamie, is it not true that some hospitals have actual disaster teams, that they do some specialized training within that group that they then sponsor to go out to some of these events?
Yeah, it happens. I know here in Maryland, Shock Trauma and Johns Hopkins both have teams that go to different areas, and either to disaster areas or to just third world areas without medical resources, and provide care at a first world level in a third world community. So we see that in many places, but also to disaster responses. And in this area, we have a lot of and I think many hospitals, especially trauma centers, have a lot of docs that are in the reserves as part of the armed services. And sometimes they get activated to go and respond to some of these disaster areas as well.
Wow. So where do we find this book? I know people are going to be clamoring to read this book.
Yeah. Well, he said earlier, Amazon, he can get it on his website. I'm actually looking at his website right now. It's awesome. ReneeSteinhauer.com. So there's some pretty uplifting and also heartrending photos on his site there, but I think give some flavor of what's going on in that in these situations. But Renee, thanks a lot for coming on. You know, we talked a little bit about training tonight, and I just want to touch on thanking our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group. You know, one of the things that Joe and Jim bring, they both responded to the Pentagon on 9/11 with their USAR team, and they try to bring, just like you said, Renee, when they do their training scenarios, when they were brought into a system, they try to bring that experience. They try to do what they call stress immersion education to try to give some flavor of what people might expect in these situations, and so that they can have that under their belt if they aren't going to these disaster situations as a volunteer, that they can be more prepared when it comes to them. So we want to thank them, Dr. Joe Holly, Jim Logan down in Memphis, for sponsoring the Disaster Podcast. And you can find them over at ParagonMedicalGroup.com and over on Twitter at ParagonMedEDU. And we just, as always, ask you to check out their site and make sure that you say thank you, because they're people that are responsible for bringing the Disaster Podcast to you each week, and we appreciate their ongoing support. Renee, thanks a lot for coming on the show. It's great to have you on.
Thanks, Jamie and Sam. I've enjoyed meeting you guys, and good luck to both of you.
Sam, where can people find you?
Well, in the usual social media places under Sam Bradley 11 and certainly on the disasterpodcast.com. I'm loving having these authors and these people that are out there and can offer us real world experiences and their perspective on them. I want to find more of them. But these people have so much to talk about, and I'm sure you have questions. So please come up on the site and ask your questions, or, you know, anything we can't answer, like where do you find training for this kind of thing, or where do you start with different NGOs and that kind of thing. I'm sure Renee would help us answer some of those. So please do come by the site and leave your comments. And where do they find the PodMedic?
Well, PodMedic under most social media sites. Of course, you can find all of my shows, including the Disaster Podcast, over at mediccast.com. And, of course, disasterpodcast.com is the home of this show. And as Sam said, leave a comment, get interactive, tell us what you want to hear more of, tell us another topic that you we haven't covered that you want us to cover. We're here to serve you, and this is a community effort, just like so many things we do in disaster response. Sam, Renee, thanks so much for being on the show. Sam, you know, Renee's talked about a lot of things, and certainly the type of medicine that they were practicing in Haiti certainly isn't something you'd see in most hospital settings, obviously.
Well, and if this conversation doesn't explain it, our tagline, nothing else will. Disaster medicine is not your everyday medicine.